This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The confirmation hearings for Neil Gorsuch to become Supreme Court Justice have been marked by discussions of serious issues, from the influence of dark money all the way to abortion and torture. Gorsuch was offered up as a nominee to fill Antonin Scalia's seat by Donald Trump within days of his inauguration. Republicans had stymied Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick for the court last year, determined at all costs to preserve a conservative majority on many issues. Progressive activists had hoped that Democrats would resist Gorsuch's nomination, but thus far, it appears likely that Gorsuch will be confirmed. My guest is Corey Brettschneider. He is a professor of political science at Brown University and author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to the conversation.
So every time I think about Neil Gorsuch's nomination to fill Scalia's seat, I can't help but feel like I need to remember Merrick Garland, and that seat should really have gone to Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee. It feels like that history has been completely forgotten, that Republicans kind of want to assume that Americans have an amnesia over Merrick Garland, right?
I agree with that. I think that Merrick Garland should have been allowed to testify, and I think he should have received, as is the constitutional duty of the Senate, I think they should have considered his nomination. And yes, I think it was likely that he would have been confirmed. And you heard even Republicans in these last few days saying something to that effect. But we are where we are, and I think the role of the Democrats right now is to vet this nominee extremely closely, to ask very tough questions, and ultimately to decide whether or not this is somebody who really does live up to the expectations we have of a Supreme Court justice.
Now, the Democrats are the minority party. They really don't have much to lose if they were to behave the way the Republicans behaved in basically saying, we refuse to confirm this. This should have been Merrick Garland, and we're just not having it. Instead, they've been pretty well behaved.
Well, I mean, in my view, you know, there are different opinions about this. I think that there is an obligation of the Senate to consider a nominee sent by the president and to vet and to ask questions and to think whether or not this person is going to uphold the U.S. Constitution in a way that they would be obligated to. Now, the Republicans, as I said, didn't do that. But, you know, I think the role of the Democrats, rather than just refusing to participate in the process or just voting no on that principle, would be a mistake. I think they should do what they've started doing in the last 2 days, which is to look seriously at this nominee, not just at what he says during the hearing, but to very importantly look at the writings in particular and to decide based on the evidence whether or not he lives up to the expectations of the next Supreme Court justice. Remember, this is a lifetime appointment with decades to come, probably, for whoever is concerned.
Right, and for people with a background in law, for practicing attorneys and judges, etc., this is the peak of one's career. This is as far as one can ever go in one's career. And once you are on that court, then you really are as politically independent as perhaps anybody else in the American political system.
Absolutely. And, you know, in our system, because of the system of judicial review, the Supreme Court decides many of the most important issues, certainly concerning civil liberties. So the next justice will determine whether or not we uphold abortion rights or revoke them, whether or not we uphold the recently gained right to same-sex marriage, or whether that is revoked. And also, frankly, when it comes to let's just put it bluntly, frightening declarations of the President of the United States to violate the Constitution, this will be a fundamental place where the justices will be expected to enforce the Constitution and to stand up to unconstitutional proposals by the President.
So let's get to the heart of the issues that were discussed. And it's so important for us to understand where Gorsuch stands on many important issues. You mentioned abortion, and you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently about Gorsuch's position on abortion. And in fact, he doesn't actually have a clearly stated position on abortion. Incidentally, he hasn't really had to rule directly on abortion in the last few years of his career. So what can we infer from what he has said about other sort of related issues and try to conclude that he may have, you know, one particular position on abortion?
Yes, I mean, we don't know whether or not he would reverse Roe versus Wade. As a Supreme Court justice, the court has the ability to reverse its own precedents. So when he says, as he did yesterday and today, that there are precedents in this area, that tells us really nothing about what he would do in terms of potentially reversing the right to an abortion, which was established in Roe versus Wade and upheld in the Casey decision. But he's told us a lot about what he calls the right to make, or what we might call, and he broadly calls, not quoting, but broadly calls, the right to make intimate decisions or choices. And frankly, he's very skeptical about choice. So in a discussion of Casey, he says that he just disregards the entire rationale of the court and regards it as an opinion of stare decisis, meaning it just upholds Roe. So the million-dollar question for him is, what does he think of Roe versus Wade? And he frames it in a way that I find a little disturbing, frankly. He says that we could go one of two ways when it comes to Roe versus Wade. We could find that the reasoning in Roe versus Wade, that the fetus is not entitled to constitutional personhood with the full protections of the Constitution, that's one choice. Our other choice is to go the way of his hero, Justice White, and find that the fetus is a constitutional person, and that the fetus is entitled to equal protection of the laws. And what's worrying about that is that it's a legalese for suggesting that there should be a court-imposed national right of life of the fetus to not be terminated. That would suggest a nationally, judicially imposed ban on abortion. He never lays that out as his view, but he certainly takes it very seriously as a possibility. And as he says, it's the position taken by Justice White, his hero, in the Thornburg case.
So what can we tell about his views on gay marriage, which you wrote about in Time magazine? You can make inferences from his dissertation. And, you know, gay marriage is an issue that the Supreme Court only relatively recently had the decision on, leading to the nationwide legalization of gay marriage. And one even wonders if that position can be reversed, or is the genie out of the bottle on that?
I should clarify that Judge Gorsuch, before he was a judge, wrote a dissertation on the question of assisted suicide, doctor-assisted suicide, and took a position there too, where he's very skeptical of doctor-assisted suicide, and he suggests that we should, just as I suggested might be the case in the abortion case, apply the Equal Protection Clause to protect against discrimination, as he puts it, against the sick as opposed to the healthy. And he is very skeptical, to say the least, of doctor-assisted suicide in the dissertation. Now, you can infer from that, not just infer when it comes to the, we're inferring when we're talking about abortion, but I'll just tell you what he says about gay marriage. He's talking about the broad right to choose, and some people think that there is a fundamental right to choose terminally ill people to choose their own death with the help of a doctor, and he resists that, certainly. But what he also says in that same passage, where he's discussing that and at the same time the Casey opinion, which I mentioned earlier, is that the right to choose can't be construed as a broad right. And he's citing Justice Scalia approvingly here, because as Justice Scalia says, he's now quoting Scalia, that would lead to, I'm not giving you the quote, I'm giving you the paraphrase, but that would lead to unacceptable conclusions. And here are some of them, Justice Scalia says. One of them is bestiality. And in the same breath, he says, another one is gay marriage. In other words, this possible doctrine, the right to choose, is unacceptable because it would lead to a right of gay marriage. Now, he's writing that, as you said, before the Supreme Court established it's a Obergefell decision, a fundamental right to marry, not just for heterosexual couples, but for same-sex couples as well. But we have to get a clear answer from him on whether or not he's changed his mind. It wasn't just that he was against it. It's that the way I read this quote, and people are just welcome to look at it, he's approving of the comparison of bestiality and gay marriage and suggesting that both of them would be absurd results. The idea that the Constitution would protect them would be absurd. So that's not just a position against gay marriage. It's a suggestion that it's deeply antithetical to the meaning of the Constitution, that it might protect such a right. Now, you say, isn't the genie out of the bottle? And I guess I'd come back to what I said in the abortion case. The Supreme Court has precedents, and as a lower court judge, Judge Gorsuch had to abide by them. But as a Supreme Court justice, if he convinces his fellow justices to go along with him, he could overturn past decisions, including, I'm sorry to say, the right to gay marriage.
Let's also talk about the issue of torture. This, particularly near the end of the Bush administration and really even after the Bush administration, we saw a lot of discussion around the issue of U.S. forces and CIA and the CIA program on so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. There was a huge legal battle during the beginning of the first few years of the Iraq War, I should say. About whether things like waterboarding is legal. What did Gorsuch say during the nomination hearings about this? Senators Dianne Feinstein and Patrick Leahy, I think, asked him very good questions on this issue.
My understanding is that the nominee tried to make a distinction between being a policymaker and being a lawyer. And he says he's really, in very few instances, taken the role of a policymaker. I think he said he was on the Board of Education at one point in his local area. But when it comes to this issue, he said he never made any policy. If he opined at all ever, it was legal opinion, not personal opinion about what should be done. There was some interesting discussion, I think, though, about how waterboarding is unconstitutional, and even from some of the president's own party. I'm not positive, but my recollection is that it was one of the senators said something to the effect of sending a message to Trump that it is unconstitutional. That is clearly the case. I think that intentional torture, the infliction, deliberate infliction of pain by the executive or by any governmental entity is a violation of our Eighth Amendment guarantee against cruel and unusual punishment. So I was glad to see that, I think, obvious point of constitutional law raised.
Another thing that he was asked about was the influence of dark money in our political system, in particular, how it has helped him personally. Senators questioned him about a particular organization called the Judicial Crisis Network. This is basically a conservative organization that spent millions of dollars on lobbying efforts to stymie the Merrick Garland nomination and millions more to push Gorsuch into this position. And, you know, Trump had a field of candidates to choose from. So it's possible that the Judicial Crisis Network is quite influential and that they spent their money well. Gorsuch sort of avoided it and even got a little defensive. But this is a really important question of the influence of dark money, one that has come before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has taken it upon itself when Scalia was alive to pass rulings like the one we now know as Citizens United.
Yes, I mean, this justice will have a fundamental role, whoever it is, in deciding the question of whether or not the right of corporations to spend from their own budgets unlimited amounts of money on the grounds that it's free speech, whether or not that is or isn't guaranteed as a matter of constitutional law in the First Amendment. It has profound impact, not just on this narrow question that I laid out, which is the issue in Citizens United, but on the broad fundamental way that our democratic system operates. Because one thought is that even if this is a matter of speech, that sometimes there are compelling interests that the government has in limiting unlimited free speech in order to make sure that our democratic process functions, that there are basic values of fairness, and frankly, that it works. And so a lot of people, myself included, think that even if there is a speech issue here, and I don't think that we have to deny that in the Citizens United case, that there are compelling interests for sometimes limiting speech in the area of campaign finance reform. Because after all, the fundamental principle that undergirds why we care about free speech in the first place is that we care about democracy. We care about jointly governing. And if we can't protect our democracy, all of these other values that are based in it become almost meaningless. So that is just a crucial thing, in my view, that we allow limitations on corporate speech in particular in order to make sure the democratic system can function.
Do you feel the Democrats are questioning Mr. Gorsuch strongly enough, aggressively enough? I mean, it's one thing to engage in a show of political force. It's another thing to actually these are public hearings. They're televised hearings. It's another thing for there to be enough analytical and detailed questioning that the public gets a sense of this person who's going to be occupying a lifetime seat on a court that, you know, has deep impact over our day-to-day lives.
Yes, I mean, it depends. I think some of it's been excellent. Senator Franken was frankly amazing yesterday, confronting the nominee about his views on a decision that he made that involved basically allowing a trucker who had, to save his life, abandoned his truck, basically allowing that person to be fired and eventually blackballed from working in that area. That was very powerful. It spoke to the idea that this isn't just a position that's about law in the abstract, it's about real people. I also thought that Senator Durbin was excellent in questioning the nominee about the themes that we've been talking about. He went right to the record, to the dissertation, to the book. And as the nominee said, that's fair game to ask him about. Now, I would like to see more about that. I think that this nominee has written a lot, and he's written a lot about the natural law philosophy, which no one on the Supreme Court currently holds. And he's written about conclusions and principles that frankly seem like they threaten fundamental areas of law, even though he hasn't definitively said it. It gives us serious reason to think that he might overturn the right to gay marriage, that he might overturn the abortion right, and that he certainly considers and might be for a recognition of the fetus as a constitutional person entitled to constitutional protections and even might require nationwide restrictions on abortion.
What about the discussions on ethics and some ethical conflicts? He was asked whether he would recuse himself on dealings with a former client, a millionaire named Philip Anschutz. And also he was asked about the emoluments clause, which many people are seeing as providing a legal basis for impeaching Donald Trump and his business entanglements. What did you make of Gorsuch? Gorsuch seemed to sort of play his cards close to his chest.
He did, but you know, it was a revealing exchange, and particularly about the emoluments clause. He did note that there is a case underway by my friend Zephyr Teachout and by several of her colleagues that are trying to challenge the president of the United States on the grounds that his continued interests in his hotels and other business constitute foreign gifts and a violation of the emoluments clause. Now, Gorsuch tried to, he realized what was happening, that it was a kind of question that was trying to get him to address the question of whether or not the president had made impeachable under the emoluments clause, or at least that he had violated it. It might include the issue of impeachment or other penalties. But he did say one little thing that I thought helped the case, which is he defined an emolument as a gift by a foreign government. And that's a pretty broad definition, and it looks like the president might be guilty under that definition. So it's not as narrow as some people had wanted there.
So it'll certainly remain to be seen if Gorsuch is confirmed to the court, which he likely will be, how he will address these issues that involve Trump when they make their way to the Supreme Court. Corey, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us. And we'll post links to the articles that you've written from our website later today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Corey Bretschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.